A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. Glad you're with me on the program today. Hopefully you had a very Merry Christmas and are getting ready for a Happy New Year as well. I just want to take a second to say thank you to the folks who reached out. I gotta say, I was fully prepared for Christmas to be, quite frankly, a real bummer this year. And it was not. It was not. Obviously, you know, there was some sadness and melancholy about the fact that this is the first Christmas without Missy. But it was also, I think it was a good day. You know, the twins who are still living at home had a good Christmas. And honestly, I had a good Christmas as well. So anyway, I just want to say thank you to those folks who have reached out. And just a holiday programming note, we will be off on New Year's Eve, New Year's Day, and then, of course, Friday. You know, we normally don't do a program anyway. So we'll have shows today and tomorrow. Tomorrow we're going to be talking with James Pinero, who is, I believe, is the executive editor of New Criterion. But more importantly, for the purposes of this program, he is the possessor of a New York City carry permit. One of less than 20,000 people in the Big Apple who has a New York City carry permit. He wrote about this in the pages of the New York Post a few days ago, and it was such a great, you know, firsthand detailing, A, of how he became a gun owner, but then how he became a legal gun owner in New York City. And I reached out to James, asking him if he'd be interested in coming on the show, and he said he was, so it should be a great conversation tomorrow. It's a great conversation today, as a matter of fact, too. Stephen Gutowski from The Reload will be with us here in just a moment or two, talking about the big Second Amendment stories of 2025. And, you know, the more we start thinking about it, the more big stories we kept coming up with. This was a really significant year in terms of our right to keep our arms. And while there were some setbacks, yeah, I would have loved to have seen constitutional carry become law in North Carolina, for instance. I think when you look at the ledger, far more positives than negatives for gun owners over the past 12 months. And again, we talk about it in pretty good amount of detail with the Reload, Stephen Gutowski. Take a look and a listen. Stephen, thanks so much for coming on the program. It's good to see you again.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Is that, I always love your band shirts. Is that a Sublime band shirt?
Sublime.
Ah,
yes,
very good.
Very 90s good. Band peak.
I'm going even more obscure. This is actually a band called the Scabs. Whoops, I meant to show the other side, not the flip off the first side. But there you go.
I love it.
We're gonna just go ahead and let that go. I'm not gonna restart the interview. So you know, it's kind of trite, I know, but it is almost the end of the year, so it is the time where a lot of folks are taking a look back at the big stories of 2025, and I thought that's what we could do today. I'm curious, is there one particular Second Amendment story that stands out to you as like an obvious, this is the biggest story of the year?
Yeah, probably, I don't know. I would think anything the Supreme Court does on the Second Amendment is big. Now, it's, you could say the Second Amendment section at the Department of Justice, just because that's something totally new, mm-hmm. And has actually had some fruit this year. The Supreme Court stuff is potentially a bigger deal because whatever the Supreme Court decides in these early days of their Second Amendment jurisprudence, even though we're, you know, 250 years into the country, we haven't had a lot of Supreme Court jurisprudence on what the Second Amendment does and doesn't mean. So anytime they weigh in on that, even if the case might not be the highest profile issue that people are hoping for, it's incredibly significant because anything they say, whether it's, we like to say dicta doesn't bind the lower courts, but in practice, it kind of does. Certainly the lower courts, if they want to go in a certain direction and they can find some dicta from the Supreme Court, they will absolutely use that. We've seen that a lot post-Bruin. Mm-hmm. But so they accepted two Supreme Court cases on the Second Amendment. They also had, of course, some gun cases and pretty significant ones, like the Smith & Wesson case with Mexico trying to hold American gun makers liable for violence in Mexico, which they were unanimous in tossing out that challenge in an early stage. And so that's very significant for the industry, though not you know, not a, it doesn't wipe away all of the challenges. There's still significant challenges out there that the industry faces. But, you know, Supreme Court is where I would go to, just because they're so early in the Second Amendment jurisprudence that anything they do on that front is going to echo for the ages, so to speak.
Yeah, no, and I think you're right. And it's not just the cases that they accepted and the cases that they decided, but also, you know, like Snopes versus Brown, the cases that they rejected, right? That was something that, you know, that was a case that had actually gone up before the Supreme Court. It was GVR'd after Bruin. So the Supreme Court granted cert, vacated the lower court decision, sent it back down. And so there was an interest, it seemed like, by the Supreme Court, right, with Snopes. Fourth Circuit reiterated, nah, we don't think these guns are protected by the Second Amendment. Goes back up to the Supreme Court. It's in conference, what, 15 times,
yeah,
I think, right? Before all of a sudden it's denied cert, along with the challenge to Rhode Island's magazine ban. We get the comment from Justice Brett Kavanaugh that, hey, this doesn't mean we're agreeing with these bans, but we expect to take up, you know, a hardware case in a term or two. I think that also is significant as well. But I would agree with you. I think that, you know, as significant as the DOJ Civil Rights Division taking on and defending the Second Amendment and the establishment of the Second Amendment section, the establishment of the Second Amendment section happened just a matter of weeks ago, right? So I think that's really going to hopefully bear fruit next year. And it may be that that's the big story in 2026.
Yeah.
But this year, as you say, this is, you know, the Supreme Court took two Second Amendment cases this year, right, with Wolford versus Lopez and then U.S. versus Hamani. That's significant. It's the first time that the court has taken two 2A cases in a single term. And
also it came at like a moment where, because they denied Snopes, there was some, you know, it wasn't clear that the Supreme Court was going to start taking up Second Amendment cases again, right? Like,
right,
there was that huge gap between Heller and Bruin that, you know, then we got Bruin and Rahimi pretty quick succession, but it wasn't a sure thing that they were going to start taking up a lot more, especially because a lot of these cases have, you know, been 6-3 on the surface, but there have been a lot of concurrences, and, you know, it's not exactly clear where all the justices are on the limits of the Second Amendment or the scope of the Second Amendment. And that certainly, I think, came through in the denial of Snopes. Like, where exactly are Roberts and Barrett on the Second Amendment questions? Now, they've been in the majority with all of the conservatives, except for Rahimi, obviously, was 8-1 with Thomas in the dissent. But, you know, they've been on the same page to some degree, but they clearly aren't all in lockstep necessarily. And so it wasn't necessary, you know, it wasn't clear that they were going to start taking up a bunch of Second Amendment cases, even though there's good reason to do it. This court has been on the lower end of volume for how many cases they take. And they'd obviously been skittish about Second Amendment cases in that 10-year, 12-year gap, right?
Between, right.
You know, it was 14 years, I think, between Heller and Bruin. So just taking up the cases, I think, says something.
I think you're right. And, you know, in particular, Wolford versus Lopez, right? I mean, U.S. versus Hamani, the government had asked the Supreme Court to take that particular case. There were a number of other challenges to 922G3 that the court is now kind of holding on to. But, you know, when the government says, hey, look, there's a problem here, we need the Supreme Court to resolve it, I think that carries some weight with the court, right? Wolford versus Lopez is a different animal. In fact, you know, that case is up at the Supreme Court on the basis of a preliminary injunction. So that case has not even been fully, you know, briefed and tried on the merits, which is interesting in and of itself, because after Bruin, you know, we kind of, I don't think kind of, I think we got told by the Supreme Court that we're not going to intervene in these emergency motions. You know, we want these things to be fully fleshed out before we take a look at it. So what do you think was appealing to Wolford? Was it the low hanging fruit of the default ban, that, you know, even if there's some disagreement, as you say, among the justices about, you know, what gun-free zones might be a constitutional, banning lawful concealed carry on all private property by default, was that just an easy call, you think, for a majority of the court? And all right, well, let's go ahead and take this and knock it down.
Yeah, I think there's probably a couple things going on there. One is that, like, it's a simple, straightforward, single question that they have to answer. And the default swap or vampire rule, whatever you want to call it, it's is unique in history, and it's rare in the country right now. Like you have several states that have adopted it post-Bruin as their way of kind of trying to severely restrict gun carry while complying with Bruin, the letter of Bruin, right? That's the idea here. But the outcome is you can actually have fewer places in reality that you can actually carry. You know, the right to carry is probably more restricted under this rule than the Bruin, the New York carry regime that was in place that the Supreme Court struck down. So that's maybe part of it, is just like the practical aspect of it. And that it's, yeah, pretty straightforward. And this wasn't something. Now, you know, obviously Hawaii has some argument that there were analogs in the past, and the court's going to decide whether there's validity to that. But also, like, the lower courts, the only one that upheld this type of restriction was this Ninth Circuit panel. And they only upheld Hawaii's version of it. There was another version in California that they struck down. So, plus, I will say, too, like, as an example of how the change in perspective from the Department of Justice, from the Biden administration to the Trump administration, has had a real world impact this year. They filed a brief in this case as well to say, which is unusual, not something you see. And if the DOJ is not a party to this case,
right?
But they said, hey, Supreme Court, please take this case. We think you should take this case up. And, you know, there's plenty we can criticize as well to what the Trump administration has done. But this is an area where you can see that real world impact from having a more pro-gun DOJ to having one that was obviously much more anti-gun in the previous administration.
And, you know, and to that end, and, you know, I know that we talked on the Reload podcast about that dichotomy that exists right now at DOJ, where, you know, the Civil Rights Division under Harmy Dillon is really taking the lead in you know, challenging state and local gun control laws. Whereas, you know, U.S. attorneys in the civil division, is, you know, embracing and defending, pretty much every federal gun control statute out there. I think maybe there's one exception about, you know, gun bans on 18 to 20 year olds. I think the Solicitor General has very studiously avoided taking a position on the merits of that law, even while encouraging the Supreme Court, not to take up a case on that issue right now. But for the most part, right, and certainly when it comes to things like, you know, NFA challenges, the DOJ continues to defend the National Firearms Act. You know, the $200 tax stamp on suppressors described as a modest burden on our Second Amendment rights. So there is that weird dichotomy that takes place. But as you say, you know, the Civil Rights Division did intervene in Wolford. They have, you know, again, requested and participated in oral arguments in Illinois before the Seventh Circuit, dealing with Illinois' ban on so-called assault weapons and magazines. And there are going to be a lot of opportunities for the Civil Rights Division to, again, advocate, even if not leading directly in litigation, but to advocate for the Supreme Court to take up more cases because, you know, as many cases as we've seen the court deal with this year, I mean, there are a number of other cases that are piling up, right? There are, I think, what, four separate challenges to various gun bans for under 21s so that the court has considered in conference, still just kind of holding on to a number of other prohibited persons cases. And then next year, we should see the Seventh Circuit's decision about Illinois' gun and magazine ban. We should see the Third Circuit's decision about New Jersey's gun and magazine ban. Mm-hmm. And all indications are, you know, I don't want to read too much into this, but based on what we heard at oral arguments, based on the makeup of the Third Circuit, it is, I think, more than likely or more likely than not that the Third Circuit is going to find fault with New Jersey's gun and magazine ban. That would create that circuit court split. Maybe that makes the cases more attractive to the Supreme Court. There are gun and magazine ban cases pending before the court in conference right now. So, you know, do you think that will continue to have an impact if the DOJ, at least on the Civil Rights Division side, continues to advocate for the court to, you know, to take up these cases sooner rather than later?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think it will. And it does seem like that, you know, Harmeet Dillon at the Civil Rights Division, you know, as far as it's specifically concerned about Second Amendment stuff, like she really seems to be the one driving, or at least that division seems the one driving most of the noticeable practical changes that have a positive impact for gun rights advocates. Mm-hmm. And I do think I would expect that'll continue. You know, we maybe thought early on, maybe this stuff is just a little bit performative or whatever, and it's not. There's not a lot of meat here yet, but she's has followed through after, you know, they formed this section, they filed this suit against Washington, D.C.'s assault weapons ban. So that's the first time we've seen the Department of Justice try to go overturn a state level or, you know, D.C.'s not a state, but, you know, localities. Assault weapons ban
right.
directly themselves. That's significant. It might not. Yeah, you know, we talked about it on my show, right? Where. Mm-hmm. You know, they probably have a better chance of winning than like Heller 2 did when Dick Heller challenged the assault weapons ban a few years back. And maybe they'll have a little bit more of a strategic advantage when it comes to Supreme Court review. Although if that's the one being reviewed, that means something has gone wrong for probably right. in a certain sense for pro-gun advocates, because you have several more cases before that one that seem better suited to get taken up quicker. Mm-hmm. You know, you touched on another thing that I think is one of the most substantial developments this year that hasn't actually borne fruit yet, but is like a huge hurdle that's been overcome for gun rights advocates. And that's the potential change in balance on the Third Circuit, where we had two more Republican appointees. And so now it's shifted to be majority Republican appointee. And that matters much more than I think people realize, because you've had a long period. I think one of the reasons you had that big gap between Heller and Bruin is, you know, just general, the court makeup for those years was not one where I think they were eager to take Second Amendment cases. But also a lot of the most significant restrictions that are passed at the state level, like an assault weapons ban, you know, like magazine bans, like universal background checks, things of that nature. They're passed, obviously, in deeper blue states. And the issue is the way that we appoint justices here, judges here in the United States, is that the local senators have some say in that process, even though the president is the one who picks them. There's a blue slip process. And so you tend to have, not this is necessarily always a bad thing, but this is the reality of how the system works. You tend to have more conservative circuits that govern more conservative states like Texas and the Fifth Circuit. And you tend to have more liberal circuits that govern the more liberal states like the Ninth Circuit in California, right? And the issue is that all of the most severe restrictions we've seen in the United States at the state level have come in those blue states in those liberal circuits. And so it's been very difficult for gun rights advocates to win cases against those laws in those circuits, and therefore a circuit split doesn't develop on something like an assault weapons ban.
Yeah.
And so now there's a real potential, and including in a case that's going on right now that the Third Circuit took on bonk. And the Third Circuit has been taking several Second Amendment cases on bonk, meaning the full court is going to hear the case.
Yeah. And in doing so, I'll throw out another Latin term, doing so sua ponte, right? Which means mm-hmm. that they're doing this not necessarily at the request of one side or the other. They're doing this of their own accord. They're deciding for themselves, okay, we're going to hear this case on bonk. And you know, the reason why you would do that, of course, is that if you think there's a majority of the court that disagrees with that earlier decision, right?
Usually, yeah. And you know, we don't know. We won't know until these rulings come out. But there's good reasons why people are assuming that the Third Circuit is now likely to strike down a number of these strict gun laws in places like Maryland or or Delaware, right? And so
yeah, Maryland's Fourth Circuit, so
apologies.
Yes. But Delaware's Third Circuit, yeah.
Delaware has a lot of these laws as well. And so, you know, the reason that all matters is that the Supreme Court, really their prerogative is their, you know, their biggest job as a court is to settle disputes between the lower courts. And mm-hmm. so if there's no dispute, it's not that the Supreme Court can't take a case like that. They will sometimes, but they are much more prone to take cases where the lower courts disagree with one another, and specifically the circuit courts, not necessarily district courts. You know, there's lots of district right. judges out there that they're not going to take up every little squabble between them. But when you get to that circuit level and there's some disagreement, that's really what the Supreme Court is designed to do, is take those cases. And so now we have the Third Circuit being the ones who create that real potential for circuit splits on all these major gun issues.
Yeah, including, again, you mentioned a couple of cases that the Third Circuit has already agreed to take on bonk, but, you know, we're looking at, I think gun control activists in general are getting very interested in the idea of permits to purchase. We know that there's a bill that's going to drop in Virginia, for example. Delaware's permit to purchase law went into effect, I think, just a few weeks ago, maybe a month or so ago. That's being litigated as well. And that is a Third Circuit case, right? Fourth Circuit has upheld Maryland's handgun qualification license, which is essentially a permit to purchase, which gives the green light to, you know, Democrats in places like Virginia to run with their own bill. If you are a Virginia gun owner like Stephen and I, and you're worried about this, maybe the Third Circuit will ride to our rescue here in the months to come. But as you say, I think that is a really significant development because, yeah, you can't challenge a ban on so-called assault weapons in the Fifth Circuit because there are no states in the Fifth Circuit's jurisdiction that has a ban on assault weapons, right? So right.
The Fifth Circuit would probably strike down an assault weapons ban, but there isn't one in the Fifth Circuit, so they don't get the chance.
Right. Which is why, you know, Fifth Circuit, I think we've seen some interesting federal cases come out of that jurisdiction, but yeah, not a lot of state level gun laws. So as you're looking ahead to 2026, you know, obviously, again, litigation is going to continue to be a huge story for our right to keep and bear arms. But I just mentioned Virginia, where, you know, Democrats have a governing trifecta, at least they will here in a few weeks. What do you see on the horizon at the state level? Do you think, you know, as we head into the midterms, right, Democrats are preaching this message of affordability. We want to, you know, they're talking a lot about economics, which to me, the smart play would then be lay off of the gun control stuff. But I don't think that Virginia Democrats are going to be able to help themselves.
No, I don't think it's realistic to expect that they wouldn't pass at least a number of gun control bills. Maybe they don't pass all of the dozens that they passed when Youngkin was governor and could veto them. You know, there does become some effect of like they might be less willing to vote for certain things if they know they're going to become law. That does happen, but probably not enough of an effect to rely on for especially some of the bigger ticket items. Now, the last time they had this control, they did fail to pass an assault weapons ban, but I think we've talked about this before. It is a different atmosphere now.
Yeah, much different.
So, you know, you still, I think most every Democrat in the Senate had already voted for assault weapons bans, you know, the last 2 years. Mm-hmm. And so the Senate is probably the bottleneck because that's where they have the slimmest majority. I mean, and it's also like, that was another significant thing that happened in 2025 was the elections went very poorly for gun rights advocates, probably mostly just because of the connection between gun rights advocacy and the Republican Party. And the Republican Party just had a bad year. But also up in Maine, you had one of the first times we've seen a ballot initiative for a red flag law pass. Mm-hmm. And in a state where they had rejected previous ballot initiatives for like universal background checks back in 2016.
Yeah.
So negative stuff, certainly for gun rights advocates in the elections this year. And that will have real world consequences next year. Like you're asking about here. I mean, I think it would be, you know, best case scenario is probably you get something like what Colorado did, where it's not a ban on sales, but it's a permit to purchase law effectively for you know, AR-15s and other guns that they like to target. And then hopefully you have the bright spot would be the courts, right? As we just talked about, like there's reason to think that the courts might strike down some of these things. And the courts already struck down Virginia's universal background check law. So, you know, maybe that's another area where locally advocates can have an impact.
And Florida's open carry ban too, you know, and again, we're talking about state courts doing these things, right? Not federal courts. I don't think we can ignore what's happening. In fact, I think it would be a huge mistake for gun owners to ignore what's happening at the state level, even in terms of Second Amendment advocacy, right? I mean, we talk a lot on your program, on my program, about, you know, national groups and the work that they're doing. But, you know, in the vast majority of these lawsuits, these national organizations are teaming up with state level gun groups, or even, you know, individual gun owners who might belong to these state level gun groups. So I would just say, you know, to gun owners out there, yes, join the national groups that are fighting for your Second Amendment rights, but don't sleep on the state level groups that are operating in your backyard. I mean, you know, in order to be effective, we need grassroots advocates at the state and local level too. So support those organizations, because they're going to play a critical role, I think, in 2026.
Yeah, and I think Virginia in particular, I'm sure that they'll try to recreate the playbook they had the last time Democrats controlled all the levers of the state government, which was, you know, the VCDL in particular here. They have a lobby day. Yeah. They had massive turnout for that to oppose a number of the gun restrictions that were being considered. And then you had as well the Second Amendment Sanctuary movement, which got the vast majority of counties in Virginia to sign, you know, to agree to a declaration saying they wouldn't enforce certain kinds of gun restrictions that they think are unconstitutional. So, you know, that sort of grassroots level impact, it did work to a certain degree. It did not prevent all of the gun bills from passing last time around, but it did prevent that assault weapons ban. And it did, I mean, if you remember initially, the plan was actually more of a confiscation plan.
Yeah.
The
first, no grandfather clause. Yeah.
Yeah. So that got stripped out pretty fast. And then what they went to the actual legislature with was more traditional, you know, sales ban. And that failed as well. Now, again, different time than now. Well, I'm not sure it'll work. But if there's anything that could make it work, it is like local grassroots advocacy. Not, you know,
well, and I think Democrats are beginning to learn that lesson, too. I mean, you know, you've seen this, right? They've introduced two gun control bills to date. Right. In 2019, when they got that governing trifecta, first thing they started talking about was a ban on so-called assault weapons. I mean, that was like out the gate. Right. So by late November of 2019, early December of 2019, you already had the Second Amendment Sanctuary movement that was sweeping across the state, where there were hundreds of people showing up in, you know, small rural counties to county supervisor meetings, thousands of people showing up in bigger counties, and tens of thousands showing up for lobby day in January of 2020. I think Democrats, I think they're smarter. They're not making that mistake. They're keeping
their cards
very close to the vest.
That's what you'd need to have any impact this time around, because of the way the election went. This was a pretty much a landslide election. The only reason the Senate is still close is because they weren't up for election. The Democrats won, what was it, 14 House seats? That's not usual. That's at least of the last, you know, modern history here in Virginia. You don't see huge swings like that, and you don't see like supermajority level control in either one of these houses. So that's, you know, Democrat, it's going to take a lot to convince them not to move forward with this. And it'll probably be, you got to focus on the senators and see if you can convince them not to at least go for the most harsh stuff. Now, you know, some of the stuff as I just mentioned, some of the stuff they passed has been found unconstitutional. So maybe that also will give them pause. Usually doesn't, right? to be frank, but maybe it does this time around. And then I think that, you know, looking forward to 2026 beyond Virginia, the elections are going to have a huge impact. You know, and I would say just on the, even just looking at the legislative side of things, you got the first federal like pro gun legislation through Congress and since the PLCAA, really, which was 2004. So I know it wasn't what everyone had hoped it would be in terms of the scope of how the reforms to the National Firearms Act, but it was something, and that's more than you've seen in a long time. And you did actually as well see impact from, you know, the gun rights groups complaining about the deal that they were given. They got at least got a little bit more than they would have. They didn't get everything they wanted. You know, so there's multiple reasons for that, but I should highlight that is something that did actually happen that is notable about 2025.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And we're going to see the results of that right at the beginning of the year. You're not going to have to pay tax on suppressors or short barrel rifles and shotguns or any AOWs. So that is a real world benefit. And I'll look to see, it'd be interesting to see how that impacts the market too, because I would assume there's probably pent up demand to come out and now that you don't have to pay the $200 tax stamp, I would expect to see a lot more silencer sales, which I think the gun market needs right now. But, you know, as far as legislation goes, that's probably it. Federal level, you don't get a lot of major legislation in an election year.
Yeah.
Polling looks poor for Republicans, so I don't know that they're going to want to touch anything controversial, potentially controversial. And so I expect very little legislation at all in 2026, let alone gun legislation.
At the federal level.
The federal level, yes.
Yeah. All right. Well, listen, Stephen, I know we'll be talking a lot next year, and I appreciate you helping us wrap up 2025. Folks should check out The Reload. I mean, honestly, all the time, because Steven is doing fantastic work over there. The Weekly Reload podcast as well. And again, man, I appreciate your friendship. Certainly appreciate you coming on the podcast and look forward to doing this again here in a few weeks.
Absolutely. Love talking with you. Appreciate you having me.
Absolutely. Happy New Year, Steve.
Happy New Year.
My thanks to Steve for joining us on the program. And yeah, looking forward to talking to him again in the new year. Before we get to today's Armed Citizen story, our good deed of the day, our recidivist report, I want to go back to what I said about state level gun groups. I got a email over the weekend from Daniel in Ohio. He says he's been listening to the show since he had the 3-hour program on NRA TV. Still miss the longer format, he says. You know, I do too. And maybe in the new year, I'm not making any promises, but you know, it certainly won't be every day we'd be able to do a 3-hour program, but maybe once a week, maybe once a month, we'll try to have like an expanded, you know, Rogan-sized version of Cam and Company where it's, you know, 3 hours long. I'd like to get back to that on at least an occasional basis. Anyway, Daniel says, will there be an opportunity this spring or summer to have a representative from state gun rights groups that we typically don't hear from? Daniel lives in Iowa. He says, Iowa's not the only one, but it'd be nice to hear from the Iowa Firearms Coalition. He says, our state has an open governor's race in 2026, and the only Democrat elected to office on a statewide basis currently is running for the governor's seat. And so I just want to, I will respond to Daniel's email, but I do want to say that, yes, you know, I hate to say it, but when I got Daniel's email, like, you kind of have gotten away from that, and not intentionally so, but, you know, we've had, typically when we talk to state level groups, it's the states where there's a lot of activity taking place. Chuck Michelle with California Rifle and Pistol Association, Jim Wallace with the Gun Owners Action League. But, you know, as Daniel's email reminded me, there's a lot going on, even in states that we think of as Second Amendment friendly, that we need to be talking about. So, Daniel, yes, I'm going to make a concerted effort to have more representatives from state level gun groups, and not just those in blue states. Holly Sullivan with CCDL is another example of, I think, a state level 2A advocate that we have on the program on a regular basis. But yes, I don't think you'll have to wait until the summer to see folks from the Iowa Firearms Coalition on this program. Buckeye Firearms Association out in Ohio. Hopefully, you know, Phil Van Cleve we've had on from Virginia Citizens of His League. And I imagine we'll be talking extensively with Phil in the new year, given what's coming down the road in Virginia. But, you know, the West Virginia Citizens of His League, Arizona Citizens of His League. There are, again, a number of fantastic state-level Second Amendment groups that are operating. And, you know, we talk about the Second Amendment movement as a grassroots movement, and it doesn't just move at the federal level, right? So we do need these state level organizations to be as strong as possible. And yeah, that's going to be one of the things that I'm going to make a conscious effort to do in 2026 is to regularly feature folks from state level organizations. So appreciate the email, Daniel, and Happy New Year to you and yours. All right, let's turn our attention now to today's Armed Citizen story, our good deed of the day, and our recidivist report. We'll start there with a case out of Texas, Fox 7 in Austin reporting on a repeat offender in Hays County who was arrested for 3 separate shootings, including one that resulted in a SWAT standoff. 21-year-old Abraham Herrera, now facing several charges for his role in 2 drive-by shootings, as well as a standoff with SWAT in which he refused to surrender. String of shootings dates back to November the 3rd, when Hays County deputies responded to shots fired in Kyle, Texas. At the scene, law enforcement found a homeowner who was seriously injured after multiple shots had been fired into his home. Investigators determined that the incident appeared to be random, with no identifiable motive. Hays County Sheriff released a photo of an SUV, which was believed to be the suspect, the vehicle that the suspect used as they drove by and fired into the home. No arrests were made initially. And then on November 12th, Hays County SWAT called out for a barricade incident in the town of Buda, Texas. Deputies have been investigating reports of gunfire in the area when they confronted Abraham Herrera, who then fled into a wooded field, refused to surrender. They were eventually able to take Herrera into custody without injury. He was charged with evading arrest and detention, which is a Class A misdemeanor, unlawful carrying weapons, another Class A misdemeanor. disorderly conduct, a Class B misdemeanor, and a third-degree felony charge of tampering and fabricating with evidence. That was November the 12th. November the 14th, Hayes was released on bond. And then weeks later, on December the 1st, investigators learned about a drive-by shooting in Martindale, Texas, happened the weekend after Thanksgiving. Suspect in that case, also Abraham Herrera. Texas Rangers provided evidence to Hays County investigators that helped establish Herrera as the likely suspect in that case, as well as the drive-by shooting in Kyle in early November. So he's now been charged with aggravated assault with a deadly weapon, $250,000 bond for the shooting in Kyle. December 19th, he was arrested on an outstanding warrant from the Texas Rangers. And he has separate charges for disorderly conduct with a firearm, tampering with physical evidence, and evading arrest. His total combined bond amount now set at $409,500. Again, the charges that he was arrested on back in November the 12th, three misdemeanors and a felony, right? So probably not going to be held without bond for something like that. But, and at the time, you know, authorities did not have any connection between Herrera and the previous shooting. And that third shooting had not yet taken place. But I'm still very curious about what kind of bond was set for Mr. Herrera after he was taken into custody with that that SWAT standoff. He was charged with at least one felony at the time, but that doesn't necessarily mean that the bond that was set applicable to the charges that have been filed. So we'll keep our eyes on the cases of Abraham Herrera, and hopefully we won't hear any more about three more shootings allegedly connected to him in the next month or so, given that bond has now been set at what I think is a much more reasonable and appropriate amount. On to today's armed citizen story from Michigan, where a homeowner shot and killed an armed intruder on Christmas. This doesn't sound like this was a random encounter. Police actually say that the suspect in this case drove about an hour away to this home. And in fact, just in the last couple of hours, there's been an update now. So we have learned from a statement from the Livingston County Sheriff's Office that the man who was killed was the estranged husband of a female acquaintance who was visiting the homeowner on Christmas Day. Deputies were called out just after 7 p.m. on Christmas to a report of suspicious activity and shots fired. When they got there, they found a man with gunshot wounds pronounced dead at the scene. The homeowner was also wounded and was taken to the University of Michigan Hospital in Ann Arbor. Thankfully, his injuries not believed to be life-threatening. According to a preliminary investigation, the man who was killed entered the home, fired multiple shots at the homeowner, hitting him twice. The homeowner returned fire, according to the sheriff's office. And again, the man drove about an hour from the Lake Orion area to Livingston County. Doesn't sound like the woman who was the wife of the estranged husband was injured, thankfully. And, you know, I'm glad that this homeowner, frankly, was in a position where he was able to act in self-defense. You know, we don't, some of us anyway, and I think I'm guilty of this. You know, sometimes I think, all right, I'm at home. I am secure. I don't necessarily need to have my gun on me. In this case, if the homeowner had not been able to quickly access his firearm, police probably wouldn't have shown up on the scene of a justifiable homicide. And instead, they would have shown up at the scene of a double murder. So, yeah, you don't need your firearm until you do. And you never know when that's going to be, right? It may be, you may have an inkling. We don't know if this estranged husband had made any threats beforehand. But you know what? Individuals intent on doing harm don't always telegraph their actions. And that's why we have to be prepared and remain prepared for the unexpected as well. All right, on to today's good deed of the day from Lawrenceburg, Kentucky, where a member of the city council there saved a couple from a house fire on Christmas Day. That's scary. It was a guy named Joe Marshall, who's a city council member. He was walking around his neighborhood on Christmas Day, spotted flames coming from a home one street over from where he lives. He called the fire chief there in Lawrenceburg, William Kurtzinger. But then Marshall actually went into the burning home to help the couple who lived inside get out. He said, once I got close to the entrance, I could see a back bedroom was on fire. There was an elderly couple that lived in the home. Woman said she had opened a closet door, saw flames. They were trying to get out, but apparently were having some trouble. So Joe Marshall went through a side door, was able to reach the couple. He said, by the time I grabbed him by the hand, I said, we got to get out of here. And then I saw her behind there. And by the time we got him outside, the house was engulfed. Neighbors brought water, brought blankets, helped the couple retrieve belongings from the home. He said a lot of neighbors, the fire chief actually said a lot of the neighbors stayed out here, helped us the whole time that we were here. Joe Marshall said he didn't think about his own safety during the rescue. He says, you know, you can replace material things, but you can't replace life. So I thank God that I was able to be there at the right time to help him out. He said, he's no hero. He said, I'm just doing what any other ordinary person would have done. And, you know, I mean, look, we have these good deeds every program, right? And most of the time I'm picking and choosing what story I'm going to highlight. But that doesn't mean that everybody would have done what Joe Marshall did. I think we'd all like to think that we would have. But there are some folks who would have called 911, and that would have been it. Sadly, there are some folks who probably wouldn't have even picked up the telephone, right? So it wasn't just about being in the right place at the right time. It really was about doing the right thing. And while we have more heroes than maybe we realize, I think it is also the case that not every one of our fellow Americans would put themselves at risk in order to save the lives of another. So Joe Marshall may not call himself a hero, but I'm going to. All right, that has got to do it for this edition of Bearing Arms, Cam & Company. Again, I want to thank you for being a part of the program. I am looking forward to seeing you back here again tomorrow as we wrap up the new year by talking about another significant story of 2025, the fact that the NYPD is actually issuing New York City concealed carry permits right now. Still takes a lot to get one, but like we learned earlier this year, 17,000 permits have been approved since the Bruin decision. There's a long way to go, but that's not nothing. And we'll talk with one of those permit holders on tomorrow's Bearing Arms, Cam & Company. In the meantime, have a great rest of your Monday. Look forward to seeing you back here again tomorrow. Be well. Be safe. And be free.